All right, let's get underway. I'm Bill Shambra, and I'm director of Hudson Institute's Bradley Center on Philanthropy and Civic Renewal, and it's our honor to be a co-sponsor of today's event. And it's my honor to moderate the second half of this discussion today on the President's Budget Commission, and we'll focus more particularly on the potential impact on the poor, although there was quite a bit of conversation about that in the first panel as well. As all of our distinguished panelists can tell you, for they have, every one of them has been centrally involved in the nation's policy debates for the past three or four decades, the issue before us today is by no means new. Indeed, it was very much present at the dawn of the conservative era, when the newly inaugurated President Ronald Reagan sought significant reductions in discretionary social programs. It's largely forgotten today, given the savage reputation of the so-called Reagan-Bush cutbacks. But President Reagan insisted that the cuts that he was proposing were completely compatible with, and in fact were essential for the preservation of a generous and compassionate safety net for the poor. Critics, of course, were not persuaded. The headline of one of Robert Pair's articles in the New York Times from that period read, "Benefits for Poor Face Deepest Cuts." And so we return once again to a discussion of the tension between spending reductions, tax reform, and an adequate provision for the poor with a panel of seasoned veterans of those debates. We'll hear first from Stuart Butler of the Heritage Foundation. Next, Robert Greenstein, founder and executive director of the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. Then we'll hear from Bill Frenzel, a guest scholar here at Brookings in Economic Studies, who represented Minnesota's 3rd District for some 20 years in the House of Representatives. And finally, we'll hear from Robert Reischauer, currently the president of the Urban Institute, who served as the director of the Congressional Budget Office from 1989 to 1995. So, Stuart.
Thank you. Should the poor be spared from the budget acts? A typical Ron Haskins title, I would think. It's graphic imagery. And I think at the simple level, the obvious answer is yes, that the poor are the most vulnerable. As Patrick McCarthy said, they have no skin in the game, no skin to contribute to the game, for that matter. If you look at insecurity and instability, I was on a panel just a couple of days ago reviewing the latest work from Jacob Hacker, looking at insecurity and the kind of shocks and devastating shocks that the poor encounter. We clearly don't want to chop away at that. So in this sort of simple sense, the idea of saying that the poor should share in the same percentage cuts or chops that everybody else takes, the answer is that they shouldn't. They should be protected. That said, let's remember a couple of things. One is, if we do fail to deal with a long-term fiscal problem, and if Dean Baker is wrong, and we do go the way of Ireland or Greece, or most recently Britain, and have a crisis of that dimension, it will be the poor and the more vulnerable who will be first in line to take whatever hit is meted out. I think it's also important to recognize, if we don't solve this long-term problem in ways that spur economic growth and sustain the economy, the poor will also be the ones who take the biggest hit. And so I think the conversation about revenues and tax policy and all of that has to be seen in this context, not of an accounting measure, but as a dynamic economic issue. So I think that's very important. The critical point that I kind of want to underscore, and which I think all the commissions actually do, is that it isn't a question of saying who gets chopped or who gets fenced off from the chopping. It's a question of saying we must fundamentally reform the way we do things and restructure what we're doing, so that we can achieve the objective of dealing with the long-term situation in ways that do protect the poor in an effective manner, in line with our values, in line with our objectives. And I think that does require us to look at redesign as a critical and essential part of how we look at it. And I think the commission approach absolutely does that and gets this sort of front and center into the discussion. We must certainly start and focus on looking at redesign for these budget purposes at the upper income level and for retirees rather than younger people first, and others have talked about this. If our aim is to get retirement security for people in America within our ability to afford that, we need to look fundamentally at our social insurance programs in this country. I think the one difference between my friends who call themselves progressives and myself is that they're in favor of Warren Buffett getting regular Social Security checks and subsidized Medicare, and I'm not, and they're the progressives. We've got to rethink what these social insurance programs are for, and I think that would lead to a very different design if we did that. We've also got to look at areas like healthcare that others have said, so I won't go into that. We've also got to think about our objective of not only dealing with the immediate needs of the poor, but assisting and making sure we have a society where the poor can move up the economic ladder. I and Bell and others and various institutions have taken part for a long time in a project from the Pew Foundation about economic mobility. What programs and approaches are effective in enabling people to escape poverty and to move up the economic ladder? One of the most important publications in that series was one done by the Urban Institute, Gene Sterley. And he said, if you actually want to look at programs to help mobility, there are lots of programs that purport to do that in the federal government. There's just a couple of problems with them. One is that if you actually look at many of them that have been examined, they don't succeed in doing that. Look at the mortgage interest deduction to help people become homeowners and move up the economic ladder. There's almost no evidence that this actually helps people to move up the economic ladder, and we don't have deductions in Canada and many other countries. And then the other thing is that in many cases we don't even know if these programs are effective. So we have a lot of programs that we don't even know if they achieve the objective of helping the poor escape poverty. So I think if we're talking about trying to deal with this problem, one of the first necessary steps is to actually look at these programs and see what works and what doesn't work. If we do that, I think it suggests that in a number of areas, if we're going to reach our objective, as the Commission laid out, in terms of dealing with the problem, we've got to re-examine fundamentally how we address certain areas that absolutely are critical to the poor. Let me just name a few very quickly before, in my two remaining minutes. One is education. My older daughter has now just started drawing a paycheck for the first time. She is a sixth-grade teacher in an inner-city Philadelphia public school. She is in a disaster zone. She is desperately trying to teach to enable kids to escape poverty through education. She is in a dysfunctional institution, in a dysfunctional school district, in a dysfunctional concept of education in our country. So if we're going to look at dealing with the long-term problem, we have got to look at institutions like that that are absolutely fundamental to the poor. When we look at the welfare system, we made some important progress in 1996 that Ron Haskins and others were involved in to begin to try to create a welfare system that looked like it was done on purpose, that didn't just give everybody incentives not to get back into the mainstream and so on. We've made some progress in going in that direction. As part of a redesign and restructuring to deal with how do we help people escape poverty more effectively at less cost, we've got to continue and expand our reforms of the welfare system. We have to look at savings policy. If we're going to look at tax reform and we're going to look at other strategies to enable the poor to be much less vulnerable to shocks in the future and to move up from the floor, we've got to look at various ways to promote savings in this country. We certainly know that a tax-only strategy is not real effective for people who don't pay tax. And so other approaches, automatic enrollment mechanisms that the president's proposed and others, we've got to look at in the context of dealing with this long-term budget area. And yes, indeed, tax policy. I also favor looking at a structural reform of our tax system. I think on both the spending and the tax side, reform and restructuring is the critical approach and element to getting this equation right. And when you look at tax reform, including some of the things that the Commission proposed. I think there's got to be a lot of discussion in that area. A simple new value-added tax or a sales tax is clearly going to hit the poor more than it is going to hit those at upper income levels. So on all these areas, I think if the Commission's basic theme of saying we've got to combine reaching objectives, our deficit objectives, with restructuring and reforming both the revenue side and the spending side is absolutely correct, and that that does apply to the poor as well as to the rich. Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Greenstein.
Thank you. In 1990 and in 1993, major deficit reduction plans were enacted, the first on a bipartisan basis under the first President Bush, the second under Clinton. Both plans reduced poverty at the same time that they reduced the deficit because they were carefully designed to do so. Both plans met the principles that at the beginning of today's session, Luis and Patrick laid out. As you heard from Bruce Reed, Olson Simpson espoused a similar principle of at least protecting the disadvantaged. But one needs more than principles, one needs the appropriate design. When you look at the Bull-Simpson plan, the conclusion I think it leads to is it would lead to significant increases in poverty and hardship over time. You have to get beyond a lot of the non-detailed analyses. We've heard in today's session, in fact, from two speakers so far, that the Social Security part of the plan reduces poverty. It's probably more likely to increase poverty than reduce it. Here's why. The argument that it reduces poverty is that it has a minimum benefit that raises people at the bottom. What none of the prior speakers said, however, is that to qualify for the full minimum benefit, you would need a 30-year earnings record. The data show that only 20% of people reaching retirement who have the low earnings over their whole lifetime would qualify for the full minimum benefit. They could have been years out of the workforce raising kids. They could have such low skills in education that they have difficulty being employed year after year. They could have faced racial discrimination in the labor market. A lot of these people would actually end up with Social Security benefit cuts because they didn't qualify for the minimum benefit. Now, I'm not one who thinks that you cannot touch benefits in Social Security. I don't support the pledges on that front. But the Bull-Simpson plan takes two-thirds of its Social Security savings from the benefit cut side over the first 75 years, four-fifths by the 75th year. And when you do that, you do hit people in trouble. Elderly widows at $15,000 or $20,000 a year under the plan would face both significant Social Security benefit reductions over time and increases in Medicare copayments at the same time that their Social Security benefits are going down. The larger problem here, Bell Sawhill said a little bit about this at the end, the larger problem is the lack of balance. The plan is, the overall Bull-Simpson plan is two-thirds budget cuts, one-third revenues. Unlike Rivlin Domenici, which is more 50-50, both in its Social Security component and in its overall component. Turn to non-defense discretionary spending. There are a lot of important programs and services for low-income people there. Rivlin Domenici, by 2020, cuts that part of the budget about 15%. Bull-Simpson, about 22%. It's a 50% larger cut. I don't see how you possibly take more than a fifth out of total non-defense discretionary in the real political world and not hit a lot of low-income programs quite hard. We're not going to cut the FBI 22%. We're not going to cut NIH research 22%. Other things would have to be cut more, very likely including those programs for people at the bottom. What I'm most concerned about, there are areas, to be sure, tax expenditure stands out, where the way Bull-Simpson approached it really advanced the debate. But there are other areas where I think it set the debate back. I'm going to cover two. Health care. Medicare and Medicaid are rising at rates that are unsustainable. We all agree with that. But for 30 years, Medicare and Medicaid costs per beneficiary have risen at the same rate as private sector costs per beneficiary. Medicare and Medicaid pay less, not more, per beneficiary than private insurance does. They pay providers less, especially Medicaid, and they have lower administrative costs. For this reason, we appeared to have a semi-consensus among policy experts for a number of years, espoused by people like Gail Walensky, who worked for the first President Bush, David Walker, formerly of the Peterson Foundation, Peter Orszag. None of these people are thought of as flaming left-wingers. All who at various points, like many other analysts, said, you cannot just constrain sharply Medicare and Medicaid growth in the absence of slowing health care cost growth system-wide. If you just try to hit them, you will end up with more of a two-tier health care system where lower-income people on Medicaid and those lower-income beneficiaries on Medicare who can't afford to go out and supplement the Medicare benefit package by buying supplementary insurance end up not sharing in advances in medicine or being denied important treatments. I think when you look at this health care cost cap in Bowles-Simpson, which is unlike countries like some of the European countries, is a cap only on public sector health care costs and doesn't even adjust for the changing demographics, where we'll have an older population and older people have higher health care costs than younger people. It's hard to meet that constraint without pretty severe cuts in Medicaid and Medicare over time, despite the rate of growth of private sector health care costs. Finally, the plan calls for limiting expenditures and revenues both to 21% of GDP in future decades, arguing that was the historical average of earlier decades in the latter part of the last century. Well, in the earlier decades, the population was younger, health care costs were smaller than they are today. We hadn't had 9-1-1. We didn't spend money on Homeland Security. We didn't do Iraq and Afghanistan. We didn't have the costs for years to come of veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And we didn't have the kind of deficits we now have, so interest payments are lower. If none of those things had occurred, if health care costs were the same as 30 years ago, if the age of the population 20 years from now was the same as it was 20 years ago, if 9-1-1 had never happened, yes, you could have expenditures at 21% of GDP. But you can't do it in coming decades without draconian changes. Bob Reichauer, Rudy Penner were involved in a National Academy of Science panel on the deficit that reported earlier this year. It set forth four paths, two which I think Rudy described on the Hill in testimony as more extreme. One did almost all of the hit on raising taxes, the other most of the hit on cutting spending, and then the two that were in the middle. And they outlined in the plan how draconian, either on the tax increase side or the budget cut side, the two more extreme paths were. Well, the extreme budget cut path was, guess what, 21% of GDP. And that's the level that's sort of laid out in Bowles-Simpson. One last example. A lot of these plans call for tamping down the employer health exclusion, and somewhat fewer employers would offer coverage, and more people, say, under health reform, would get subsidies to buy coverage in the exchange. There is an argument that this would be a better targeted, more efficient system. What it does is it reduces the role of government in tax expenditures and substitutes on a targeted basis subsidies for people who can't otherwise afford it to buy coverage in the exchange. But in so doing, and it doesn't really lessen or increase the role of government, it moves it from tax expenditures to subsidies, but it raises revenue as a share of GDP and it raises spending as a share of GDP, probably in a way that increases efficiency. Yet, if you have a constraint that neither revenues nor spending can exceed 21% of GDP, once you've done that efficiency, you have to whop other programs to stay within 21%. So the bottom line, I think, is you really have to design these programs, these budget reduction plans, carefully. I think you can't go beyond 50-50 on revenues and spending. You can't have health care caps on public sector costs only without controlling system-wide cost growth. And you can't have artificial constraints like the 21%. Otherwise, despite your best principles, over time, it will be inevitable that we put in changes that I think would significantly increase poverty and hardship.
Thank you. Mr. Frenzel.
Thank you very much. It's been a long morning. We're kind of getting down to the bottom of the barrel, but cheer up. When rush hour comes on, we'll go back up to the top again. There aren't a lot of first-class pearls left to cast, and so we're going to be traveling some ground that other speakers have been over. But that's okay, because some of these points are worth making again and again. In the first case, whether the country is on an unsustainable path, despite at least one speaker's rejection of that thought, I think all of the commissions, and there have been many of them, and most budget analysts really believe that their studies corroborate the fact that there is a real problem. I happen to be in the class of those budget scolds who believe the problem is terrible. It is more imminent than a lot of people believe, and to tell you the truth, I'm terrified about it. Then to go to the question of what's going to happen with the budget acts, first there has to be a budget acts. As much as I would devoutly wish for a sharp blade aggressively wielded, history tells us that it will be dull, rusty, seldom used, and poorly aimed. And I think the last week's performance on the tax bill and the continuing resolution show again that the policymakers, particularly under the dome, are not ready. Maybe the concrete is cracking, as former panelists suggest, but there's still an awful lot of feet stuck in many layers of concrete. And so this may take time, and it may, as panelist Penner suggested, take some kind of a crisis to get us there. But if we get there, we look at those plans that have been spread before us, and I'll look mostly at the Bowles-Simpson plan, the President's Commission, simply because that seems to have the most horsepower and generated the most talk. And if you look at the guiding principles of that report, one of them stands out. It says, protect the truly disadvantaged. And I think all of the panelists have agreed that they should be protected. However, there be a lot of debate on what's truly and how they should be protected and whether they need to be protected under exactly the same systems that we have today. I think if you look at all the reports, they suggest a strengthening of the safety net, a concentration on necessities, and probably a little concentration on truly and what we really need. Now, once we decide that the poor should be spared, then we have to think a little bit about how. And for the policymakers, that's going to be difficult because the advocates on the part of the poor are not always speaking with one vote. And if indeed we had an axe wielder, the disharmony would make his job very difficult. The axe man needs clear advice, and it looks to me like he probably won't get it. There are a couple of other points here, and one is that if something like the commission's plan was is seriously considered, the old ways of doing business are going to be severely tested. And we're going to have to think like Thomas Alva Edison about better ways. Do the feds have to do everything? Can the states do some of it? Can the privates do some of it? Is there a better and a cheaper way to deliver services? And I think in the future, as we face the Axeman, if we face the Axeman, compassion is going to count a good deal less than outcomes. And the policymakers who are going to have to make the difficult choices are going to demand to know about outcomes. Due to the limitations of time, I want to skip directly to taxes, because we've had a lot of talk about this in the previous panel and a little bit on this one. And there's going to be a great debate on it. And I've heard the President's Commission bill described as 70-30, two-thirds, one-third, and 60-40 this morning. Testometer doesn't tell me exactly what it is. To me, it looks a little tax-heavy. I think the debate is going to be on a figure already discussed here. What's the percentage of GDP that we're going to spend on the running of the government, and how much are we going to tax the people? For me, the 21% figure is too high. But we'll have to see. I believe if we can come to some great cosmic agreement, the great compromise, some kind of tax component is likely. It seems to me unlikely that either the Democrats or the Republicans will completely subside, no matter what future elections bring us. At some point, the negotiators are going to have to figure out what's a good deal and what isn't a good deal. I didn't put the slide rule to the commission's report, but had I been serving on the commission, I would have said, yeah, there's a lot of stuff in here I don't like. The health care stuff is pretty fuzzy. The tax reform is very strong. Social Security is pretty good. I got to vote for it. We're in real trouble. And sometime the policymakers will come to that decision, and there will undoubtedly be some increased taxes in our future.
Good. Thank you very much. Mr. Reischauer, bring us back to the top of the barrel, please.
Okay. I gather from Bill's introduction that I'm the grounds at the bottom of the coffee cup. I'm going to throw out five pretty basic points on this topic, but before I do so, I want to just make two comments on the previous panel and their wisdom. Many on that panel heard the cracking of concrete. I admit that I'm hard of hearing, but even with my hearing aid in, I hear a different sound. I grew up in New England, and anybody who grows up in New England next to a lake knows that as ice forms, it gets crackly. It crackles more and more the harder the ice gets. And that's what I'm hearing, is ice forming. And I would predict that 2 years from now, we will not be having a robust debate during the presidential campaign about which major structural tax reform to enact, but rather we will hear both sides promising a continuation, if not an expansion, of the tax cuts that the Congress is engaged in enacting right now. My second comment on the first panel is related to Bell's revelation that she expects to receive over $1 million from the Social Security system, and assuming that she wasn't referring to Medicare as well, you're going to ruin my joke. I was going to say that there are one of two. Okay, Sarah. There are one of two possibilities here. The first is that she has succeeded where Ponce de Leon failed, and she will live a long time. And the other is that we're going to have rampant inflation, in which case I'm going to go out and buy tips right after this meeting is over. The first observation I'd make on this topic is that at the rhetorical level, we should be heartened because both of these commissions have, both meaning the Rivlin, Domenici one and Bowles-Simpson, have placed a lot of emphasis on protecting the disadvantaged. as Bob has pointed out, in execution, they both come up a bit short. I think that we can overlook that because there are building blocks there which can be changed and strengthened. But one important thing to point out is what was in neither of these commissions' reports, and that is a repeal or major scaling back of the Affordable Care Act. And that is a huge change that, if kept in place, is going to work to the benefit of this segment of the population over the next decade or so. As others have pointed out, there are components of the tax reform proposals and the Social Security ISA which we can build on, and particularly that's true with respect to the Rivlin Domenici plan, where notwithstanding the fact that they are imposing a sales tax on the nation, they're trying to compensate for that with an earnings credit that is quite generous and indexed and beefed up child tax credit. The second point I'd like to make has to do with discretionary spending caps, I think, which all of us think might be in the offing in the not too distant future, and all of us are concerned that in the push and shove and arm wrestling that will take place as Congress tries to fit $1.4 trillion worth of aspirations into $1.2 trillion worth of appropriation bills, that the programs for the disadvantaged will come up short because the lack of power and political clout of this group. My guess is there's very little that can be done about that, and so the right thing to do is to try and transform this into an opportunity to the extent that it can. We have to admit that programs directed at vulnerable populations, disadvantaged, like other policy areas, there are some duplicate ones, there are some inefficient ones, ineffective, ones that aren't particularly well targeted, and beginning to think how these we can combine programs, change the way they're operated so that when the total goes down, the impact doesn't go down proportionately. Think creatively about how we can use the Cut and Invest Committee, if that's the right vehicle, to consolidate, rationalize, improve administrative structures, and demand more accountability from those who are actually producing the services from that come from these programs. Third point I'd make is that not all reductions in programs that are directed at the disadvantaged hurt the disadvantaged. And too often, the argument takes place, oh, Medicaid is being cut. That must be terrible. Well, you know, if we're cutting dish payments, upper payment level scams that states have been running, it's not the end of the world. If we're raising the drug rebate, it's not the end of the world also. You know, we've gone through this shameless example of this in the last year, in which the Republicans have treated the Medicare cuts in the Affordable Care Act as if they affected the beneficiaries, when the beneficiaries were really seeing augmented services provided to them. And we shouldn't fall into that trap. Fourth point. Is that there may be some areas where, looked at over the long run, policy changes that disproportionately negatively affect disadvantaged populations in the short run have positive offsets over the long run. And here I'm thinking about things like soda taxes, higher alcohol and tobacco taxes, changes in post-secondary loan programs that have enticed youth to enroll in educational programs from which there is no real payback from. And the final point is that if there is some large package, I think it will be almost impossible to shield the disadvantage from all of the collateral damage that would take place. I mean, here you think of things like if we raised gas taxes, if we increased rates that power marketing authorities charge for electricity, it's going to have disproportionate effects on lower income people. You can choose to, you know, get all exercised about that, throw sand in the wheels of any progress that there might be to reduce the deficit, or you can look, as the Domenici-Rivlin Commission has done, at broader kinds of offsets like the earnings credit to do compensation across the board. As several of the other speakers, I think, have said, I think the disadvantage will be hurt disproportionately if we wait for a crisis to cause us to, in a very haphazard and rapid way, to respond to rising interest rates or falling dollar value or something like that, and that they and we as a nation will be better off if we deal with this in a measured way now.
Thank you. Very good. I have a general question for the panel, and that is this. Several panelists have mentioned that the various commissions, have carved out a kind of an exception for the truly disadvantaged in one respect or another. But I have to say, in the reaction to the various reports, the public reaction and the congressional reaction both, we haven't seen a lot of attention to this. In fact, I would say that I may be wrong about this, but I dare say this forum is one of the very few national forums at this level of prominence to tackle this, the issue of the commission's reports and the disadvantaged. Is that an accurate observation? Is Congress, our Congress and the public, ignoring the problems? Is this a long-term trend? Is this something we should be concerned about? Is it the result of the fact that the current economic difficulty is so widespread that, you know, we're just temporarily ignoring that issue in our discussions? What's the story on that? Does anybody have any?
Well, I do think that one of the things that's happened in the last few years has been that there's been the creation in the public and political mind that the truly vulnerable and disadvantaged group in America is middle-class people.
Yeah.
I mean, everything is sort of, you know, the embattled poor middle class. And I think we see this in the tone of the reaction to all this.
Right. Well, despite my criticisms, I do think it was useful that Bowles and Simpson kept espousing as a first principle, even though I think their plan violates it seriously, that we should be seeking to protect the disadvantaged, and that did emerge in the debate. The thing that I think you referred to an exception, I don't really see much of an exception in the plan, and I think what we really need to distinguish between are programmatic specifics. It is true that, as Bruce Reed noted, that the plan does not identify lots of deep cuts in low-income programs. That's true. But where you have these sweeping caps, particularly if they're set too low on domestic discretionary programs, on the rate of growth of public sector health care costs divorced from what happens to health care system-wide, then I don't think there is much appreciation. I don't think many of the commissioners understood it. I don't think policymakers or the media understand that those have potentially very serious consequences for low-income people. I agreed with the points Bob Reischauer made at the end, but I do think there's some caveats that are needed. I certainly agree that we need to distinguish between hurting disadvantaged people and changing low-income programs. There are various reforms that could be made in various low-income programs that don't increase poverty or hardship. But it's not as though there are massive amounts of money there.
No.
if you are cutting non-defense discretionary 22% instead of 15%, there's no way you're not going to have some real tough hits there. In the area of Medicare and Medicaid, you know, as someone, our center helped design a lot of the Medicare and Medicaid savings reductions that are in the Affordable Care Act. There isn't a whole lot left. Bob mentioned a couple of areas on drug rebates and state financing schemes, but a lot's already been done there. The amount of money left there is modest. It wouldn't be enough to totally slow Medicare cost growth to GDP plus one. So that's where I think the debate has fallen short. There's this gap between this nice lofty principle of protect the disadvantaged, and since policymakers, including the commission, never like to have to identify the specific program cuts, it's easier for them to have some kind of cap on growth that starts a few years out, and the next group of policymakers have to fill in the blanks. And when you set up those kinds of caps in too severe a fashion, that's where I think inevitably we're going to have hits, probably disproportionate hits, on the less powerful and people with lower incomes.
Well, I think the reason we're not seeing a lot of debate is pretty obvious. It goes back to Gary's question. The public admits we have a problem, but believes that we can solve it by cutting someone else's benefits. And Congress, of course, was delighted that 14 votes were not achieved in the president's commission. And so that the pressure was off of it, and it can now dance its traditional war dances prior to the presidential election, and they probably look at any of this sort of work as a 2013 operation, if at all. And that's why I think these forums are useful, so that even though we sometimes wind up as wonks talking to wonks, at least we have a better idea of what the whole system is developing.
That's great. Yeah.
I just don't think any of this is real at this point. I mean, the commissions have issued reports, but nobody's really shooting with real bullets at this point. And maybe it will occur as part of the budget process next year. Maybe it will occur when the debt ceiling debate begins and is resolved, and people then have to fulfill the promises that they've made. But at this point, it's just not real.
Yeah. Reischauer makes a great point that there's a distinction between what's really happening in policy on Capitol Hill and the commissions. And it's, the tax cut, of course, Bruce Reed referred to the tax cut deal. But let me just give a little comparison. And I'm looking, there's Ron. I'm looking at Ron here. So Ron, of course, was an architect of the 96 welfare law. And people like myself said, you're moving the program, the basic welfare assistance program for poor mothers with and kids, to a block grant. What's going to happen in recessions? And the answer was, we're going to take care of it. We're going to have a contingency fund so when need rises in recessions, it can get drawn on. And from 1996 to the present, we've had a contingency fund. Well, at the end of this month, the contingency fund is at zero. Legislation has just been passed that allows it to die. There will be zero contingency fund for the rest of this year with a 9.8% unemployment rate. They couldn't get 60 votes in the Senate for something that would maintain it. There are going to be significant cuts for the poorest mothers and kids in states across the country, and the argument is we can't afford it, we have a deficit. Meanwhile, we're about to extend tax cuts that average $100,000 a year for millionaires, and we're about to pass an estate tax regime that, compared to extending the 2009 estate tax parameters, is worth $1 million additional tax cut apiece for the estates of the top 0.25% of people who die. So this is kind of why I get so concerned about things like caps without specifics. The risk is that when the rubber meets the road and we do have to make the hard choices, that this is an illustration of where they go. And I think, you know, in response to your earlier question, I do think we need more public focus on some of the specific detailed trade-offs. There could be others, like the one I just made. You know, we had a whole thing on death panels. We actually now have our first death panels. They're the state of Arizona is denying liver transplants to people on Medicaid because they don't want to put enough money into Medicaid. The death panel turns out only to apply to people who are poor. So these are the kinds of things I think need to be part of the broader debate as we discuss how to reduce deficits.
So do we agree as a panel that when we descend from the level of abstract principle where we can say things like sparing the truly disadvantaged, that as we descend to the level of actual operation, I think you're making the case that when you do that, then politically it's much easier to target the programs for the poorest of the poor. Is that what's going to happen? Or is that?
Well, I think that's one interpretation of what can happen, and it's certainly a risk. But I think that, in response to what Bob said, both Bob said, I guess, well, certainly Bob Greenstein.
Bob's.
Now, let's sort of look at this on a kind of a larger strategic view. Bob Reichow, as he said, was brought up in New England. I was brought up in Old England. And maybe our ice is a little different in England, but I seem to remember you get a lot of noise at the spring as well as ice begins to break up, and the flowers tend to follow that. And I think it's important to kind of look at it in this way. Had this commission got straight into the details of very specific things and had, you know, a 3,000-page report of all the details, do we really think that the focus on strategically what we should do and the impulse for change would have been more pronounced? I think to the contrary. Everybody would look at all the things that affected them. I think the great merit of this commission, just like, you know, the breakup of the ice in the spring where I came from, is that it's begun to change the nature of the conversation that stressed the broad principles and the broad reforms that are necessary. And if that can take hold, and if we can do our best to make it take hold, then the context in which the details do in fact get developed will be much, the context will be much more pronounced and people will buy into it, which will help lead to detailed changes more in line with what our broad principles should be. And I think that's the critical way to think about this. And yeah, you know, and let me just sort of say in one moment, when we start thinking about the health theory, I agree in one level with what Bob Greenstein said, that if you just look at caps in general and caps in healthcare and so on, and don't deal with the way the system operates, this is not the way to think about it. But the reverse is also true. If you start thinking about only the details of what kind of structural change you want in the health system, including Medicaid, and don't start thinking about the pressure needed through a budget or through a cap to force people to make real decisions within those potential system change, they won't happen. The history of health reform is lots of talk about delivery system changes and so forth. And yet, and some are very good, and some are put into place. But the trajectory of cost keeps going up, because until you put a ratchet down on that, in combination with a serious conversation about the details of reform and restructuring, you've got to do both of those on both the spending side and the tax expenditure side in healthcare to get this right. So both are necessary, and the commission is focused on the broad sort of broad picture of caps and broad design first.
Let me disagree. Somewhat disagree with Stuart here. Here's what I'm really afraid of. As other speakers have said, unlike, say, in Social Security, where everybody knows the options to restore solvency, they can't get agreement, but you can make all your menus, we don't really know the things that in the long run we need to do precisely in healthcare to slow the rate of growth system-wide. The single biggest advance forward for all its warts is the Health Reform Act. It has pushes pilots and demos, all sorts of things to try to find new ways to reform the delivery system. It pushes comparative effectiveness research. It has the Medicare panel that looks at this and recommends changes. It has some unheralded provisions that allow whoever is the administration to, by administrative action, administer various, put into effect various cost-saving developments that result from the pilots in the demos without having to go back to Congress and run the gamut of the healthcare lobby. Do we know that this will significantly slow the rate of growth of healthcare costs? No. It's simply a platform and the most promising thing we have. Also unheralded, and contrary to what some speakers on the first panel said, the Health Reform Act also really put some ratchets on starting in about 2018, both on subsidies, which would only grow with CPI, not healthcare, and on the threshold for the excise tax on the high-cost insurance plans. Here's where I'm heading. I think we can guarantee we're going to see a number of members of Congress say, what we need to do on health care is just put on this expenditure cap that Bowles and Simpson proposed while repealing the Health Reform Act. The expenditure cap has nothing in it to try to get you to slowing the rate of growth of private sector health care costs. You have some of the same people who want a cap, who want to repeal the specific savings, like the overpayments to Medicare Advantage private insurance companies that MedPAC called for years and didn't get enacted to health reform. So part of my fear is the use or the misuse of aspects of the Bowles-Simpson plan. And I want to be wrong on this, but I will bet my bottom dollar we're going to hear a major push from various powerful people in Congress to put caps on Medicare and Medicaid in the name of slowing health care cost growth, while in the same breath they try and repeal either the entire Affordable Care Act or, at a minimum, the very provisions in Medicare, in pilots, in demos, in comparative effectiveness research that are the things that give us the most promise to try to find ways to slow system-wide growth.
We have time for a couple of questions, I believe. So let's go to the audience, and I remind you of the injunction to be brief, to ask a real question, to identify yourself. Yes, right in the back, right next to that.
Hi, my name is Kayla Ramsey. I was happy to hear education come up as we talk about addressing the disadvantage. And so in light of the news coming out that me being like my generation and younger, at risk to being less educated than our parents and all the generations before us, can we afford to shield education from this hard deficit talk? Or can we afford not to? I'd like to hear a little more about that.
Well, I think my point was that the shielding, you don't want to shield a system that is not working. I mean, look at the dropout rates. Look at the failure of people to graduate from college and so on. It's a disaster. And to say, well, let's shield that and just keep it as is bad. To say, let's just take 10% off the top of it is even worse. We've got to say, look, if we're going to meet our objective, it's got to be within structural reform. And I think that's really the point I was trying to make. So I think all this conversation of saying we should shield various things, that's what to me is wrong with part of this discussion. It isn't a question of shielding. It's a question of saying, what is the objective that we're trying to achieve with these areas and for this population? Are we doing it effectively? If we are, and it's really really successful, then fine. We should probably invest in it. But if it's not, then don't shield it. Redesign it. And that goes for to me, the tax and revenue side, as for the spending side.
Yeah, anyone else?
Yeah. I agree with Stuart's basic point, but you don't even want to preserve and shield those things that are working well if you decide they are not the priority that the federal government should be investing money in. I believe that education is, so you can breathe a sigh of relief. But the fact of the matter is that over the course of the next several decades, we're probably going to have to decide there are certain areas that the federal government should pull itself out of and leave to the private sector or the nonprofit sector or even state and local governments, even though they're in worse shape.
I think you also, it's like everything else, you have to look at the specifics. Would one want to slash the basic Pell Grant for low-income students to afford college? No. Getting into an area I don't know well enough, I need to learn more about, but I haven't yet. Some people argue that the way the student aid system works now with certain kinds of for-profit colleges results in excessive expenditures and that there are savings to be had there. when you wall off an entire area, then you can't look at things like that. So in every area, you want to look, really get into the details, the nuts and bolts, and see, are there aspects? You know, many laudatory programs, in order to be enacted in the first place, their enactment came through a sausage-making process where certain kinds of subsidies that are more than are meritorious were given to certain players in order to make something happen in the first place. Now when we're into the mode we're into, where we're on an unsustainable fiscal path, this is hard politically. But in many of the programs, including some low-income programs, one has to look at the mechanism to deliver the service or the benefit and see if built into it was something that was put there for political reasons but results in money being spent you don't need to spend. Prime example was the change last year to direct student loans, which saved a lot of money that we were wasting paying banks and others, where we were already protecting them from risk, and then we were giving them excessive billions of dollars of subsidies on top of that. Just because one believes strongly in student loans doesn't mean there wasn't money to be saved there. So I think that's the kind of analysis one needs throughout the budget.
Mm-hmm. One more question. Okay. In the back here, yes.
My name is Yoneyama from Mitsui & Company, Japanese investment firm. My question is a follow-up question. I think U.S. strength is a growing population and growing productivity. And Mr. Obama's strategy to double the export is very good sense because world is expanding faster than at this moment U.S. So how to connect the growing power and your strengths, growing population? I think education is very important. Instead of looking at the growing population as a cost, how to energize and make competitive is very important. And in your discussion, could you elaborate how you're going to connect your strengths of growing population and growing economy? Thank you.
Yes. Who would like to take that up?
I can't look down this way.
It's a big question.
You know, I couldn't agree more with you that if we don't strengthen and improve our education system, a growing population is, not a particular advantage. I think that is one more or less bright spot in policy over the last number of years, in that both in the Bush administration, and one can criticize certain aspects of No Child Left Behind, and certainly in the Obama administration, there's been a lot of attention and policy change devoted to particularly improving the educational performance of the bottom component of the population, and one even sees at the higher education, the post-secondary level, some interest in measuring value added and looking at accountability. So I think we're going through a transformation here. There's a growing realization that we are nowhere near the best in the world in lots of areas that we have looked in at ourselves in the mirror and said, boy, don't we look good. We're now looking around the other side of the mirror, and I think that is healthy as well. But changes of this sort take a very long time to produce actual results. I'd just like to make one comment given your working for Mitsubishi, Mitsui. You said it's a great thing that the Obama administration sees future growth being export-led, and of course Germany does too, and most of the rest of Europe, and Japan is not far behind. There's the question of who's importing if we're all exporting? we need to, I guess, turn to South Asia and China and make sure they're hearing the same message.
Yeah. If we're going to improve productivity and improve our growth, it seems to me it's important to look to the tax reform objectives that were promoted in the President's Commission report, where there was an attempt to convert tax preferences into lower tax rates, particularly corporate rates, but also individual rates as well, to promote more growth in our economy and in our society. I'm not sure our population is growing as fast as you might suggest, perhaps comparably to Italy or Japan. We look strong, but I think the change in the tax system and the prospect of tax reform, in addition to more aggressive trade policies, is our best hope for economic growth.
I would just say I agree with that very much in terms of economic growth and the relevance of tax reform and marginal rates. Let me also just say, to return very quickly to the education point, I really do feel that in the United States, I mean, clearly we have some of the top universities and the most highly skilled people anywhere in the world. But we are moving steadily, I think, to a sort of almost like an educational caste system, you know, where there are certain people who are, and many of us know, have been a product of this, who are able to kind of get a good basic education, a good secondary education, and move on to university and have the means to do so. And there are other people for whom that is impossible. They will never, ever be able to do that because they are so failed by the basic education system. And even if we give them Pell Grants to go to universities, they will drop out because they don't have the underlying skills, the human capital, the social capital, to be able to take advantage of those opportunities. So I think, you know, when we're talking about a growing population younger, the future of younger people, I think getting to grips with this combination of thinking about education and those who are at the bottom of the income level here, the disadvantaged, we have an opportunity in this whole debate over the future of the deficit and how programs should be structured and so on, to really finally engage in this, what has to be this conversation about the role of education and the structure of our education system.
If I could follow up on
last comment.
On Bill's comment. I think probably the most interesting thing, looking over Bull-Simpson and the Rivlin-Domenici plans alike, is the fact that both of them have these sweeping tax reforms. And I think most analysts across the political spectrum would agree that those kinds of reforms would give us a more efficient tax system and would probably help some. One doesn't want to overstate how much, but help some on competitiveness and so forth. Both of them also are tax reforms that, unlike the 86 Act, bring in more revenue, which we need given the deficit problem. Having said that, the interesting question is how many legs those kinds of reforms really have. When you get to the tax writing committees and you move from the abstraction of greatly broadening the base and closing lots of tax expenditures to actually closing expenditure by expenditure, tax expenditures, each of which has a very powerful lobby. This is one of the things in town that is truly bipartisan. The members of the tax writing committees, Republican and Democrat alike, protect those various tax expenditures. They wrote them in the first place. And I think a lot of the corporate sector is united in wanting lower corporate rates. But if it's your particular corporate tax expenditure that's being closed, they're going to be up there trying to save it. So a real test that may or may not come in the next couple of years, Bob Reichauer is very skeptical, is, you know, can we really make progress on a tax reform that broadens the base, lowers the rates, and produces more revenue to reduce deficits? Or is it really business as usual when you have to actually end specific tax subsidies? I'm skeptical. I really want to have my skepticism proved wrong.
Do you think those interests that defend the tax preferences are any less vigorous than those that defend farm subsidies or defense expenditure? It's the same problem.
What was the final item added to the tax cut bill after the deal was negotiated by Obama and McConnell? What was the final item added on the Hill? Continue ethanol subsidies.
But that's a human right.
On that inspiring note, let's thank our panelists for a terrific conversation.